So I have suggested that the arguments that we might use to reconcile belief in God with the scientific worldview, however cogent in themselves, raise another problem for the believer, which is the problem of God's presence in the world. How do we find him, and where do we find him, and how? The ghost of an answer to that question is this: God is a person, and he reveals himself as persons do, through a dialogue involving those three critical words that I mentioned at the end of the last lecture: I, you, and why. That answer brings us up against another problem raised by the scientific worldview, however, which is the problem of reconciling our beliefs about persons with the science of the human being. Whatever philosophers have to say, it is argued, their theories must fit in to the basic truth, which is that we are organisms, distinguished from other species by our cerebral capacity, which has permitted adaptations of an order that no other species has been able to match. These adaptations include language, social emotions, and cooperative strategies that range well beyond the demands of inclusive fitness. They are what principally need to be understood by philosophers interested in the human condition. And they are understood in the first instance by exploring the context in which they evolved and the evolutionary problems to which they are solutions. Hence the growing body of literature in which evolutionary biologists and philosophers work side by side to postulate the roots of our human condition and human attributes in the daily emergencies of Pleistocene man. Most contributors to this literature insist that they are not reductionists. That is, they're not trying to reduce human behavior to something simpler than it is. They are tracing highly complex adaptations to the circumstances that selected them, in order to understand why they were acquired. And this must surely cast light on how they work for us, here, now, even if those circumstances have since disappeared. This approach promises to dispel some of the mystery of the human condition. If some feature of our mental life can be shown to be an adaptation rooted in the tribulations of our hunter-gatherer past, then a bridge has been created between the peculiarities of civilized man and the circumstances of the ape-like creatures from whom we are descended. What might otherwise appear to be an impassable gulf in the natural order between the instinctive animal and the fully acculturated moral being begins to look more like a step-by-step transition, each step being explicable in evolutionary terms. By contrast, the a priori method of traditional philosophy paints a picture of the human condition as something wholly apart from the rest of nature, as in the philosophy of Kant, for whom the concept of the person is central, but who writes of persons in such a way that it is doubtful in the end whether they are part of the natural world at all, that they end up as being purely noumenal beings. However, when philosophers try to develop an account of the human being that is founded in the Darwinian picture of how we came to be what we are, all too often they end either by describing us as far simpler than we are, or by describing the lower animals as far more complex than they are. This habit began, in fact, with Darwin, who writes thus in Chapter 3 of The Descent of Man, a book which is not usually as misleading as this sentence is. This is Darwin. If men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, there can hardly be a doubt that our unmarried females would, like the worker bees, think it a sacred duty to kill their brothers, and mothers would strive to kill their fertile daughters, and no one would think of interfering. That sentence forms part of an extended attempt to show that the sentiments of people have their precise analogies and archetypes in the animal kingdom, and that no special explanatory leap need be made in order to describe the moral sense, like the sense of beauty and the disposition to religion, as an evolved response. But if you look at the words, they have strange implications. Worker bees, on Darwin's view, do not merely have a sense of duty, they possess the concept of the sacred, too. They are fully fledged Kantian persons, whose view of the world is exactly the view that we should take were we to enjoy the kind of boarding school education that is provided in the hive. Darwin seems to be explaining the emergence of the moral sense from the instinctive social behaviour of animals by describing that behaviour as though it were already an instance of the moral sense. Such an explanation would be circular, concealing the mystery rather than solving it. Much pseudoscience owes its appeal to what I call the charm of disenchantment. It is exemplified by the explanations of human benevolence in terms of reciprocal altruism, alleged to be an evolutionally stable strategy, not just for human genes, but for the genes of any creature which can establish a reproductive benefit to themselves by doing something which confers a reproductive benefit on others. And this has been taken up by many popularisers of the Darwinian worldview in recent years, not notably, of course, by Dawkins. Take the thing that needs explaining, in this case human generosity and self-sacrifice. Find something that looks a bit like it, the alleged sharing of booty by the female vampire bat, and describe the animal behaviour in language appropriate to the human case as a gift to another, and for a brief moment it might look as though you have found the explanation. The woman who gives her time and money to the local hospital is doing what the vampire bat has been alleged to do when she gives the blood she has collected to her less fortunate neighbour hanging beside her from the rafters. The soldier who lays down his life for his platoon and the ant who dies defending the ant heap are doing exactly the same thing, acting out a successful reproductive strategy of the genes that compel them. Such would-be explanations assimilate human to animal conduct only by giving the most superficial description of both. In particular, they leave out of consideration the radically different intentionality of the human response. Human generosity is mediated by concepts like gift, sacrifice, duty, and the sacred, concepts that I shall go on to discuss later in this series of lectures, and which presuppose self-consciousness and the moral sense. The emergence of these concepts is what most needs explaining, since they create what seems like an impassable chasm in the evolutionary story. You don't cross that chasm merely by misdescribing the behaviour that creates it. The evolutionary approach also fails to account for the internal logic of our states of mind. Consider mathematics. This too is an adaptation. If you can't add, you won't multiply. But you don't need much maths to satisfy the reproductive requirements of your genes. And someone who, in addition to carrying out basic calculations, becomes interested in transfinite cardinals and higher order differential equations, is not giving much of a helping hand to the genetic strategies that brought him to this pass. Once over the hump, however, from an innumerate to a numerate creature, the human species was able to run forward into this new pasture, enjoying its wonderful fruit of futile knowledge, building theories and proofs, and in general transforming its vision of the world without any obvious benefits to its reproductive potential. Stephen Jay Gould famously describes this kind of activity as a spandrel, on the analogy of those ornamented corners between architrave and arch, which serve no function architecturally, and therefore can be decorated at will without weakening the structure. That, however, is nonsense. Once into the domain of mathematics, there is only one way you can go. Something constrains you, and it is not the clamorous demand of your genes for their useless immortality, but the constraints of validity and truth. We understand these constraints because we understand reasoning. No evolutionary explanation is going to give us an account of what we understand. It can give us a causal map, but you could understand that map without understanding mathematics. Nor is mathematics a special case. There are many ways in which people gain understanding of the world by interpreting signs and symbols. And even if there is an evolutionary explanation of how we came to acquire that kind of understanding, the understanding itself unfolds another vision of the world than that contained in the theory of evolution. Language is the most striking example of this. We don't know how it arose. The very idea of intermediate proto-languages, which are steps on the way from monosyllabic grunts to articulate sentences, has been seriously doubted, for for example, by Chomsky in Aspects of the Theory of Syntax and elsewhere. But we do know that language enables us to understand the world as no dumb animal could possibly understand it. Again, there is a hump and a boundless field beyond it. Once over that hump, infinitely many representations are available. The language user has access to the distinction between truth and falsehood, to that between past, present, and future, to that between possible, actual, and necessary, and so on. It's fair to say that he or she lives in another world from the non-linguistic creature. Since emotions and motives are founded on thoughts, his or her emotional life and motives to act will be of an entirely different kind from those of the other animals. This is surely why we balk or ought to balk at those naive theories of altruism as an evolutionarily stable strategy, to use the jargon. For altruism in people is not an instinctive thing. It is the considered response based on agape or neighbor love, which is in turn founded on the recognition of the other as another like me, so that what is bad for him is something that I have a motive to remedy. Such attitudes, which are unknown in the animal kingdom, depend upon our ability to refer to ourselves in the first person and to use the pronoun I. Thomas Nagel has a nice way of expressing what this might involve. Imagine, he suggests, a complete description of the world according to the true theory, whatever it turns out to be, of physics. This description describes the disposition of all the particles, forces, and fields that compose reality and gives spatiotemporal coordinates for everything that is. Not a thing has been overlooked, and yet there is a fact that the description does not mention, the fact that is more important than any other to me, namely, which of the things mentioned in the description is me? Where in the world of objects am I? And what exactly is implied in the statement that this thing is me? We tremble here on a vertiginous edge. The self is not a thing, but a perspective. But, as Nagel reminds us, perspectives are not in the world, but on the world. It is the distinction of perspective between the first person and the third person points of view that gives rise to many of the puzzles concerning consciousness. When you judge that I am in pain, it is on the basis of my circumstances and behavior, and you could be wrong. When I ascribe a pain to myself, I don't use any such evidence. I don't find out that I am in pain by observation, nor can I be wrong. But that is not because there is some other fact about my pain, accessible only to me, which I consult in order to establish what I am feeling. For if there were this inner private quality, I could misperceive it. I could get it wrong, and I would have to find out whether I am in pain. I would also have to invent a language, intelligible only to me, with which to describe my inner state. And that, Wittgenstein plausibly argued, is impossible. The conclusion to draw is that I ascribe pain to myself not on the basis of some inner characteristic, but on no basis at all. Of course, there is a difference between knowing what pain is and knowing what pain is like. But to know what it is like is not to know some additional fact about it. It is to retain the memory of how it felt. We are dealing with familiarity rather than information. What it's like is not proxy for a description, but a refusal to describe. This thought leads naturally to a distinction between the subject and the object of consciousness, and points to the peculiar metaphysical status of the subject. As a self-conscious subject, I have a point of view on the world. The world seems a certain way to me, and this seeming defines my unique perspective. Every self-conscious being has such a perspective, since that is what it means to be a subject rather than a mere object. When I give a scientific account of the world, however, I am describing objects only. I am describing the way things are and the causal laws that explain them. This description is given from no particular perspective. It does not contain words like here, now, and I. And while it is meant to explain the way things seem, it does so by giving a theory of how they are. In short, the subject is in principle unobservable to science, not because it exists in another realm, but because it is not part of the empirical world. It lies on the edge of things, like a horizon, and could never be grasped from the other side, the side of subjectivity itself. Is it a real part of the real world, then? The question begins to look as though it has been wrongly phrased. I refer to myself, but this does not mean that there is a self that I refer to. I act for the sake of my friend, but there is no such thing as a sake for which I am acting. Sakes are not objects in the world of objects, neither are selves. Kant wrote more beautifully of this matter than any other philosopher. The use of the word I, he suggested, distinguishes the rational being from all other objects in the natural world, and also defines his predicament as a creature both bound and free. Descartes had argued for the supreme reality of the self as a unitary substance whose nature is infallibly revealed to me by my introspective thoughts. That view, Kant argued, is profoundly flawed, for it tries to make the self into the object of its own awareness. I know myself as subject, not as object. I stand at the edge of things, and while I can say of myself that I am this here now, those words contain no information about what I am in the world of objects. Yet there are two things that I know about myself, and about which I cannot be mistaken, since my argument against them would presuppose their truth. The first is that I am a unified center of consciousness. I know without observation that this thought that I am having, this sensation in my foot, this desire, and this will belong to one thing. And I know that this thing endures through time and is subject to change. I am directly aware, as Kant put it, of the transcendental unity of apperception, the single unified owner of all my mental states. This privileged knowledge of my own present states of mind and of their common owner and unity would be described by Wittgenstein as a grammatical feature, a fact about the grammar of the first-person case. But that is neither an explanation nor a denigration. It remains true that there is in each of us a sphere of self-knowledge that is privileged, and that this sphere of self-knowledge defines the view from somewhere, which is mine. The second thing that I know with certainty is that I can give and receive reasons for action, judgment, and belief. The question why makes sense to me, and when it is asked of my own beliefs, intentions, or acts, I can respond to it with the same authority with which I know my own state of mind. My beliefs may be wrong, my intentions may be evil, my feelings may be corrupt, but when you ask me to justify them, it is I, not you, who gives the reason why. There are difficult cases here, as we know from psychopathology, but the norm is certainty, and it is for just this reason that the why makes sense. Why is a question that I can answer immediately, on no basis, and at the same time offering myself for judgment. Now, this feature of the human condition is both fundamental and mysterious. It is fundamental since it transfigures the human world, endows our actions with a significance that no animal activity can replicate, and makes it possible to describe human agents in ways that distinguish them completely from the surrounding world. It is mysterious in that there is nothing further to be said by way of explaining it. Every creature who can say I, and thereby refer to himself, is able to answer the question why. But there is nothing else about him that explains this fact. Equally interesting is the second person case, as equally interesting as the first person, I mean. We can observe and understand many things in our environment, and it is natural to seek an explanation for the things that we observe, asking why of the sun, the moon, and the stars, of the weather, the landscape, and the things that grow in it, and asking this too of the animals. But this why is not addressed to the things that we observe. We do not ask the sun to give an account of itself, or the trees to tell us how they grow. Of one thing in our environment, however, we ask why in another sense, and this is the thing we address as you. I can address objects and animals as you, of course, but only figuratively, certainly not using the word as we use it to each other, by way of calling each other to account for what we think and feel. How are you is usually the first thing that one person says to another, and it is a form of words that establishes a relation that can exist only between those who refer to themselves in the first person as I. The I-you relation is both distinctive of persons and also constitutive of them. It is by addressing each other as you that we bind ourselves in the web of interpersonal relations. And it is by virtue of our place in the web that we are persons. Personhood, in other words, is a relational condition, and I am a person insofar as I can enter into personal relations with others like me. This is part of what Locke meant when he described the concept of the person as a forensic concept. It denotes the aspect of the human condition in which we assume responsibility for our actions, account to each other for how things seem to us, provide reasons for our own and others' decisions, and praise and blame each other according to norms and aspirations that we strive to share. Hence the role of the second person case as a form of address and not just a way of describing other people. The word why has a special place in our interpersonal dialogue, in our conversations with each other. When uttered face to face, why also in a sense has a face. This is captured by Schumann in a little piece for piano which you may know called Warum. The question looks at you and into you. This interpersonal use is wholly different from the use of why in scientific explanation. Even if we respond to the question why by mentioning the cause of our state of mind, we are also doing more than this. We are accounting for ourselves. And this accounting of self to other is also something that we do self to self, when we reflect on our actions and emotions in the spirit of judgment, seeing them from outside as we see the actions and emotions of others. Contained in the question why is the remarkable fact that each of us is, both self and other, bound to other persons in a network of face-to-face encounters. Two important consequences follow from this. The first is that human beings can make up their minds to do one thing rather than another. An intention is not the same thing as a desire. You can intend to do what you don't want to do, and want to do what you don't intend to do. Intending something means knowing that you will do it and being prepared to answer the question why. Intending is not predicting. I predict that I will drink too much at the party tonight. But maybe the gods will favour me and I will find the strength to go home sober. When making such a prediction, I am seeing myself from outside, as it were, assessing the evidence, extrapolating from past observations and drawing conclusions as I would draw them from observing another. My prediction might turn out to be right or wrong, but it is no more privileged from the point of view of self-knowledge than my predictions about the behaviour of someone else. When I decide to go home sober, however, I make up my mind, and this means being certain on no evidence that that is what I shall do. In such a case, I answer the question why, not by presenting evidence based on past behaviour, but by offering reasons for action. I am, in effect, taking responsibility for an event in the future. And that means in some way bringing it within the purview of first-person knowledge. If I don't, after all, go home sober, this is not because I was mistaken in my former assertion about my intention, but because I changed my mind. may be under the influence of drink, but nevertheless it was a change of mind. The second consequence of the use of why, therefore, is that human beings are rational agents. We act for reasons and are open to criticism when our reasons seem inadequate or flawed. The question why lifts our actions out of the realm of cause and effect and places them squarely in the realm of reasons and goals. This is in part what we mean by calling an action intentional, namely that it lies within the perspective of practical reason. The agent can be called to account for it and is able spontaneously to answer the question why. Some intentional actions are preceded by a decision, but not all are like that. As Elizabeth Anscombe has argued in a celebrated book on this topic, an action is intentional just as long as it admits the application of what she calls a certain sense of the question why, a sense that I am considering in this lecture, and which, alas, she did not make as clear as she should have done. Hence, an action can be intentional even if no decision preceded it. Most of our actions are indeed like that. Now, there are many qualifications and caveats to be added to that picture, of course. And for the purpose of my argument, they must be left to one side, since I need to give an overview of what it means for us that the three metaphysical words, I, you, and why, govern our conduct and impose a comprehensive orientation towards the world. As I would like to express it, we face the world in a posture of accountability. We are called upon to justify our conduct, to be truthful in revealing our states of mind and our goals, and to be aware of the community that stands like a horizon around all our projects. Guilt, shame, remorse, and regret haunt our lives, and much of our efforts are expended on avoiding them. We live, to put it in another way, in the eyes of judgment, and those eyes are also our own. From this springs, I think, that great longing in the human heart for righteousness, for the blameless life, the life that is properly guided. And this longing is expressed in the religious attitude. Being rightly guided by the light that shines from beyond the stars, such is the promise of salvation, according to Al-Ghazali and the Sufi poets. Although I have been talking of three little words and the grammar of the personal pronoun, it should not have escaped you that I have also been discussing freedom. It was Kant who first made clear what I am assuming in this lecture, which is that free will enters our world through the little word I. Contained within the first-person perspective is a posture that distinguishes persons from all other things in nature, namely the ability to make themselves accountable for something that has not yet occurred. I will lift that stone. I will storm that fortress. I will kiss that woman. Saying such things, I change my whole stance to the world, put myself in a condition of readiness, and do so by my own free choice. Every utterance, every train of thought, proceeds by these free gestures. And to that argument, Kant added another, and for him far more powerful consideration, namely that reason tells me not only to do certain things, but that I ought to do them. I ought to help that person in distress, and not doing so, it is again myself that I blame. I focus on that very centre of being from which decisions flow, the full force of moral condemnation. Our whole way of thinking about ourselves is built upon the moral law, and since ought implies can, we can engage in practical reasoning only on the assumption that we are free. But this leads, as everyone knows, to a question. What kind of world contains a thing like me? What kind of world contains a thing with freedom and self-knowledge? Kant argued that it must be a world of enduring objects, objects with identity through time. And I am such an object. Otherwise, I wouldn't have practical reason. I am a thing which, deciding this here now, will do that there then. A world of enduring things is a world bound by causal laws. So Kant set out to prove in the immensely difficult section of the Critique of Pure Reason entitled The Transcendental Deduction of the Categories. Without the web of causality, nothing preserves itself in being long enough to know or be known. So my world, the world of the free being, is a world ordered by causal laws. And causal laws, Kant thought, must be universal and necessary. They refer to connections in the very nature of things, connections that cannot be suspended on this or that occasion and merely for the convenience of people. Building his argument in this way, by steps too many, too complex, and too controversial to detain us here, Kant drew the following conclusion. Any being who can say I and mean it is free, and any being who can say I and mean it is situated in a world of universally binding causal laws. I am governed by a law of freedom which compels my actions, and a law of nature which binds me in the web of organic life. I am a free subject and a determined object, but I am not two things, a determined body with a free soul rattling inside. I am one thing, which can be seen in two ways, as subject and as object. This is something that I know to be true, but which lies beyond understanding. I can never know how it is possible, only that it is possible. Now that is a drastic way of putting something that I will try to put more gently in subsequent letters, in subsequent lectures, in order to extract the truth from it. But it usefully brings us face to face once again with the scientific worldview, and in particular with the new way of describing human beings that has emerged from evolutionary psychology and neuroscience. Certain philosophers in our time, such as Patricia Churchland and Dan Dennett, begin from the position that I touched on earlier. They tell us that we human beings are to be understood as members of a particular species of ape, that our states of mind are rooted in adaptations formed during the long prehistorical period of the hunter-gatherer tribe, and that these adaptations are hardwired in the human brain, as Patricia Churchland is apt to put it. If we want to know what kind of thing we are, therefore, how we are motivated and fulfilled, and what we can cogently hope for, it is the brain we should be studying, not the mysterious thing called I, which is, after all, not a name or a description, but simply a context-dependent indexical term. If we take this attitude, what remains of free will? In a famous series of experiments, Benjamin Libet has used magnetic resonance imaging to explore the causal antecedents of human choice. His results show that when people choose between alternatives, there is a particular burst of activity in the motor centres of the brain, leading directly to the action. But the subject himself reports his decision always some moments after this, when the action is already, from the point of view of the central nervous system, underway. I think some of you will be familiar with the arguments around this particular piece of empirical science. Some cognitive scientists, though not Libet himself, draw the conclusion that our impression of free choice is therefore an illusion, since choice, as we call it, comes always too late, after the action has been set in motion by the brain. Some draw the further conclusion that it is the brain, not the person, that does everything, and that talk of persons and their actions is simply a loose and ignorant way of describing what should really be described in terms of a brain and the body that is moved by it. Well, imagine two people discussing what to do. The first wants to do X, the second gives him reasons for doing Y, and these reasons change his mind. When does the decision occur? Surely it occurs when the reasons have been accepted, and when that is depends upon the pace of the dialogue. I could not engage in reasoning of this kind if I did not assume that it was in my power to change my mind. Nor could you. Freedom does not reside in some event that erupts into consciousness unheralded by changes in the nervous system. It resides in practical reasoning, which is in turn founded in the relationality of the human person. The conclusion often drawn from Libet's experiment is that it shows any such picture to be confused. The brain, it is said, decides what to do, and our consciousness follows only later when the switch has already been flipped. But this way of interpreting Libet's experiment assumes that an event in a brain is identical with a decision of a person, that an action is voluntary if and only if preceded by a mental episode of the right kind, that intentions and volitions are felt episodes of a subject which can be precisely dated in time. All those assumptions are false. Sometimes an intentional action is preceded by a decision or choice, certainly, but usually the action is the choice. And what makes it intentional is not that it arose in a particular way, but that the subject can say that I did this, and in doing so make himself accountable for it. To say that we are free is to point to this fact, namely that we can justify and criticize our actions, lay claim to them as our own, and know immediately and with certainty what we will do, not by predicting, but by deciding. The Libet experiment leads to the denial of free will only because it assumes free choice to be an eruption in the stream of neural events. But to see free will in that way is to look for it in the world of objects, and not in the world of subjects where it belongs. Free will forms part of the web of interpersonal relations and comes into being as a corollary of I, you, and why. Some philosophers respond to such thoughts by dismissing the concept of freedom as mere folk psychology. In other words, part of that primitive science of the mind embedded in ordinary language which neuroscience will one day replace. But imagine what it would be like to replace our ordinary ways of understanding human action with the theories of some future neuroscience. Suppose I wonder why you have been avoiding me. I ask you a direct question, and you accuse me of betraying your confidences to a rival. I deny the charge, knowing it to be false, and ask you why you think it to be true. You recount your evidence, and I refute it. Your hostility disappears, and we agree to work together to limit the damage. Now, that kind of dialogue occurs all the time, and it is the way in which rational beings establish and build on their relations. It presupposes at every point that you and I both understand and make use of concepts like belief and desire. And it assumes that we each have first-person knowledge of our beliefs and desires, that we don't have to find out what they are, but can summon them immediately and without evidence in response to the questions why and what. Use of the first-person pronoun confers the ability to describe immediately, on no basis, and with a far-reaching immunity to certain kinds of error, the content of our own mental states, and also to put ourselves forward as accountable for our actions. Suppose we now replace folk psychology with some explanatory neuroscience. The result would inevitably undermine the use of our three metaphysical words. We would all be condemned to a third-person view of ourselves and others. Each person would become a he or a she, and no I or you would remain. We would be able to describe our mental condition only by investigating our brains, and the give and take of reasons between I and you would, since it depends on first-person privilege, disappear. With it would disappear the possibility of interpersonal relations, and with interpersonal relations would disappear language and all that has been built on it. In short, the neuroscience would be left with nothing of interest to explain. And that is just one thought among many tending to the conclusion that our way of representing the human world is not replaceable by neuroscience, not even by the neuroscience that explains our way of representing the human world. An interesting corollary should be drawn from that sceptical position. You might say of Libet's experiments that they attempt to discover the place of the subject in the world of objects. They're looking for the point of intersection of the free self-consciousness with the world in which it acts. And they do not find that point. All that they find is a succession of events in the stream of objects, none of which can be identified with a free self-conscious choice. There is a parallel here with the question that I raised last time, the question of God's presence in the world. If you look on the world with the eyes of science, it is impossible to find the place, the time, or the particular sequence of events that can be interpreted as showing God's presence. God disappears from the world as soon as we address it with the why of explanation, just as the human person disappears from the world when we look for the neurological explanation of his acts. So maybe God is a person like us, whose identity and will are bound up with his nature as a subject. Maybe we shall find him in the world where we are only if we cease to invoke him with the why of cause and address him with the why of reason instead. But the why of reason must be addressed from I to you. The God of the philosophers disappeared behind the world because he was described in the third person and not addressed in the second. Well, that's a suggestion I want to explore in later lectures. The human world, I maintain, is ordered by concepts that are rooted in dialogue, and therefore in the first-person perspective. But that perspective will not feature in the data of any science. There is no room in causal theories for terms like I and thou, and it is precisely this that gives rise to the revulsion that we feel, or ought to feel, when a philosopher explains human love, desire, longing, grief and resentment in terms like these, quotation. The brains of social animals are wired to feel pleasure in the exercise of social dispositions such as grooming and cooperation, and to feel pain when shunned, scolded or excluded. Neurochemicals such as vasopressin and oxytocin mediate pair bonding, parent-offspring bonding, and probably also bonding to kith and kin. Those remarks are from Patricia Churchland, currently a Gifford lecturer at Edinburgh. In response, I should say that the brains of social animals feel neither pleasure nor pain. Pleasure and pain are things that we feel, and we are not identical with our brains. And I feel a strong urge to protest at the reduction of I-you relationships to forms of bonding that require neither first-person awareness nor even consciousness for their achievement, like grooming, which of course horses do all the time. If this is what it is to replace folk psychology by neuroscience, I can only protest that neuroscience purchases its explanations at the cost of the facts. Indeed, we are not dealing with a new science of the human being at all, but with an outpouring of neuro-nonsense, or what Raymond Tallis calls neurotrash. This nonsense comes about because people can be conceptualized in two ways, as organisms and as objects of rational interaction. The first way employs the concept human being, which is a natural kind. It divides our actions at the joints of explanation and derives our behavior from a biological science of man. The second way employs the concept person, which is not the concept of a natural kind, but sui generis. Through this concept and the associated notions of freedom, responsibility, reason for action, right, duty, justice, and guilt, we gain the description under which a human being is seen by those who respond to him or her as a person. It is a description of a creature that sees itself as free, and also, in the normal case, as fallen, a creature with an inexpugnable religious need. And when people endeavour to understand this creature through the half-formed theories of neuroscience, they are forced to pass over its distinctive features in silence, or else to attribute them to some brain-shaped homunculus inside. What matters to us are not the invisible nervous systems that explain how people work, but the visible appearances to which we respond when we respond to them as people. It is these appearances that we interpret, and upon our interpretation we build responses that must in turn be interpreted by those to whom they are directed. It seems then that there is an impassable metaphysical gap between the human object and the free subject to which we relate as a person. The very difficulty that we encounter in our relation to the God of the philosophers stands in the way of our relation to each other. Yet we constantly cross that seemingly impassable metaphysical barrier from self to other. How is this? And if we can understand how it is, will that help us to solve the problem of the relation between the transcendental and the immanent God? To summarize, then, you can situate human beings entirely in the world of objects. In doing so, you will in all probability reduce them to animals whose behavior is to be explained by some combination of evolutionary psychology and neuroscience. But then you will find yourself describing a world from which human action, responsibility, freedom, and emotion have been wiped away. It will be a world without a face. The face shines in the world of objects with a light that is not of this world, the light of subjectivity. You can look for freedom in the world of objects, and you won't find it, not because it is not there, but because it is bound up with the first-person perspective and with the view from somewhere of the creature who can say, I. Well, of course, this is going to be the topic of my last lecture, which I have written and torn up many times for the very reason that you were indicating. I haven't a clear answer to this, obviously, but let me just say one or two things. There are persons who are not human beings. And the clearest example that we have in our own experience is the corporate person, like St. Andrew's University, which is, it may be mortal, but it's already, 600 years old? It's doing pretty well anyway, it's not embodied. It does have reasons for action, which are partly embodied in the principle here, but she has to consult, of course, with others. You know, there's a process whereby St. Andrew's takes responsibility for what it does. So a lot of what we know about each other is replicated in that sphere. And, of course, in storybooks, we have, down the centuries, there's been no difficulty in developing the concept of the person without the feature of embodiment. After all, ghosts and spirits inhabit Prospero's island and make the drama work. And they inhabit it as persons. You know, they act for reasons and are reproached for the things they do. So let's just leave the question in the air for the moment. Maybe something more can be said along those lines that can help to expand the concept of the person in a more ghostly direction. Alternatively, one could say, as Spinoza did, that sure, God has a body. It's the world taken as a whole. And that body is identical with him in just the way that yours is identical with you. Now, that's a very radical position, but not without a lot to be said for it.
We ask other persons why about certain things, namely their actions and their beliefs, their beliefs, that kind of thing. So what is it that we are to be asking God why?
Well, that's a very good question. Why? It's not only that we ask for about causes, we ask about the reasons for things. What justifies your position in the world? Having made a world, what justifies the sufferings of a particular person within it? When you ask the why in that sense, you're not asking for a cause, but you are asking for the person to take full responsibility for something, and if perhaps to amend it. Now there is a great question whether, and this is again a question I want to get on to, the question of whether prayer is ever efficacious in that sense, in the way that my beseeching you for something would be efficacious, or one would hope it would be. And I agree there's going to be a great difficulty again at reconciling the transcendental nature of God with the immanent world in which he acts.
Yes.
You articulated the metaphor there of St. Andrews as a person. Derek Parfit, in Reasons and Purposes, argues that you can refer to a person without it being a separately existing entity in the following sense, that St. Andrews, I would argue, doesn't exist separately from students and teachers and colleges and the structure of its administration. We can refer to it, but it is not a separately existing entity. It can exist as an entity. We say St. Andrews is functioning as a university, but it's not functioning as a university. But it's not a separately existing entity. Why do you therefore not conclude that the same occurs in relationship to I? That the person can be referred to, but is not a separately existing entity other than the psychology and the body and the mental events, can be referred to, but is not a separately existing entity?
Well, yes, that's a far-reaching question. Parfit's view, of course, is that you can construe the person as a collection of successive selves, and if you want, and this would make no difference to your ontology. And in the same way, you're saying you could eliminate St. Andrews from your ontology and just keep the people who compose it, and that would have made no difference. Now, I think that Parfit is wrong. And I also think that it would be wrong to reduce St. Andrews to its present or to the totality of its members. So I take, if you like, a realist view in response to both these predicaments. I think that with Locke and also with Kant, that the concept of the person is fundamentally tied up with the idea of accepting responsibility for things done and for things yet to be done. And this involves an assertion of identity across time that I must be capable of making. So I'm making that assertion, which doesn't just link a previous self to a present self, but actually identifies myself with that previous self and also with a future one. And I think that act of identification across time is fundamental to the moral life. And indeed, reading Parfit's moral conclusions only confirms my view. And I also think the same of corporate persons. I think that one of the things that's gone badly wrong in modern societies is that people haven't got a clear conception of corporate persons anymore. We need to hold corporations liable for the things that they do. And we also need to respect the way in which individuals find fulfillment through their membership of corporate persons like families and universities, schools, clubs and the rest. So I think that one needs to take both these forms of the person much more seriously.
Certain that you will do it than when you predict it, whereas it seems that you may still intend to do something and yet know that you're weak-willed and to take precautions in case you don't follow through. So I suspect that may not be quite the right way to spell that out. But then I wondered with God, I don't know whether God can be weak-willed or even change his mind, but the difference between intention and prediction for God may be less clear.
Oh, that's a good point. Of course, I was very conscious that in that part of the argument, I was going very rapidly over territory where there's hundreds of caveats. And we all know that weakness of will is one of them. This is one of the problems that lies in the way of anybody who wants to distinguish intending from or deciding from predicting in a neat way. Often, we sort of decide and make little ways out for ourselves by which look more like predictions than decisions. But on the other hand, it's only because we have that distinction between predicting and deciding that we can lose ourselves in the middle ground between them. I think the general distinction is that between taking responsibility for a future event and incorporating it into what I am now, and not doing so. Now, God, one would assume, if he acts in the world at all, takes full responsibility for it. But this leads us into another problem, the problem of God's foreknowledge, you know, which caused many a suicide in the Middle Ages, and I think we might keep up it for the course of this, these lectures.
Could I just offer a couple of observations about the word God and the word view? The first maybe it may be significant or it may not, I simply don't know, but in Latin, Greek and maybe many other languages where the nouns decline and the pronouns too, both the word for God in each of those two languages does not have a vocative case, that is, it doesn't have the special case which is used when you address someone. So it's almost as if, in saying the word or the name God, you're already saying you. And whether there is any rationale or whether that's just constant, I'm afraid I don't know. The second point around both these two terms again is, and I'm sure you know this, but this comes under the general category of the God of the philosophers. One of the most famous arguments for the existence of the God of the philosophers, of course, is Anselm's ontological argument. And it has very, very, very often been commented on that he begins his work, most famous work, with a prayer addressed to the God whose existence or necessary existence he is then going to go on to prove. So there is a very extraordinary sort of meshing there of the God of the philosophers, who presumably is referred to in the third person, and the God of to whom people pray.
That's a very interesting observation, yes. It is obviously true that people like Avicenna and so on, who were also responsible for so many of these arguments, were similarly regarded his arguments as a form of prayer. On the case, it's a very interesting observation about an absence of the vocative for deus and theos. However, Slavonic languages have a vocative, and they do make the distinction. I think Bůh and Bože in Czech, probably the same in Polish, isn't it? It's Czech, yeah. But still, interesting thought.
Yes.
The fact that Deus can be got separate vocative form doesn't mean that he can't be addressed. God can't be addressed by a vocative. But can I just refer to the earlier point? Shouldn't we really be a bit more worried by Lewis's experiment than you were suggesting? Because if the neural processes initiating bodily movements actually precede in time the consciously formed intention to do the action which those movements express, then it may be that, as you say, you have these two separate forms of discourse, the scientific one, and separately from that, you have the discourse in terms of persons. But somehow or other, in a quite literal sense, the neural discourse gets to have priority. In other words, it wouldn't be the case. ways that you could form an intention different from the initiation movement done by the cerebral cortex?
Well, I mean, this is very difficult, and I know this is a very intricate argument as it develops, but I would say a couple of things in response to that. One is that if you're simply saying that, you know, that the neural processes have initiated things before the conscious intention has formed, well, of course it's true that everybody has always thought that. Any determinist of a Kantian kind recognizes that it was all initiated before I was born. You know, and these processes have been going on, and they've culminated in this action. So it's not the discovery that this passes through the nervous system that has changed the problem of how to reconcile intention with the determination of my actions by bodily processes. So it hasn't added anything to the old problem. The only thing that it has done is identify something that looks like a decision in the nervous. If there were to be such a thing as a decision occurring in the nervous system, this is the kind of thing it would be, and that occurs moments before the guy says, you know, I'm going to do this. But suppose you tell him this. If he's got the information that's happened, he can change his mind still, as Libet himself admits. He says, you know, there's no free will, but there is free won't. So that you haven't taken things out of the possibility of rational decision making simply by identifying this process. What really matters is the extent to which giving and receiving reasons for action will change what someone does, and that is not altered by this neural mechanism.
Any last questions? Yes, last question.
So I don't understand much of this philosophy thing, but I would like to ask you a simple question from a philosophical point of view. Does the human brain tell us something about God?
Well, gosh. I think all of nature tells us something about God. Each part of nature has its own story to tell, obviously. I think more interesting is the question whether God tells us something about the human brain. You know, if my argument about God makes sense at all, it would seem that the idea of the person can be applied even to something which doesn't have a brain. So that my instinct, which is to say that the brain is simply a part of the human being, and it's the human being as a whole that matters, is confirmed by our way of talking about God. And I think that there is a tendency, of course, because of neuroscience, to think that really the human being is the brain. And that is a mistake, identifying an entity with some part of it. Indeed, there's Peter Hacker has invented a name for this mistake, the so-called myriological fallacy, attributing to a part of something the properties of the whole. And I think he's right that this is something which neuroscience is constantly tempted by. And, you know, the idea that we are just the brain and the whole secret of the human condition is contained there. But suppose after the end of the Gifford lectures, I was taken aside and my head was opened just to see exactly what caused this scandal. And inside was discovered a dead kitten on a ball of string, as Henry James says. You wouldn't alter the fact that in your mind I'd been thinking and speaking and intending and desiring through those weeks. It would just would alter your conception of the things that made that possible.
On that note, let me advise Professor John Holdridge calls to an end.
Well, at the end of the first lecture, and other lectures also, we've expressed our thanks to Roger. We will do that again in just a second. But could I say, for this matter of raising questions and offering observations, the first lecture, Tuesday's lecture, is now available on the website that's been created for the And I don't know what confidence I can say. Subsequent lectures will be available because you've seen a demonstration of our confidence in the technology to start with this. But all being well, it will be the case that this lecture has been recorded. Otherwise, poor Roger's going to have to sit in a room for a while with me running around trying to sound like an entire audience. But anyway, what we're going to do is, in fact, it already is indicated on that, is that we're inviting comments and questions and so on, a selection of which will then be put up there, and at some point in the proceedings there will be practically a kind of interview session which will also be broadcast, and those questions, observations, plus some others contributed sort of lies, so to speak, down the line by philosophers elsewhere, will form part of a kind of online seminar. So if you do have questions or observations that you felt still need a little bit of formulation, then please do formulate and send them to that site. But for now, once again, we thank Roger very much for this interesting lecture.